broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
Welcome, everybody, to another incredible Refresh Your Wealth show with Mark Kohler, yours truly, and my amazing co-host, Matt Sorensen, here talking about building wealth, saving taxes, asset protection, small business, and wow, this show is only going to get more likes and listens and followers after our amazing presidential election last week, Matt, huh? I mean, boy, up small business, huh?
Yeah, who'd have thought? Donald Trump as president. Could you even imagine that like a year ago? This is crazy. What world are we living in? But he's going to be our president. And I know that the network televisions, the news, they're all excited, even the Democrats, because you know what? People are going to finally start watching some of those TV shows, or their listenerships could even go up, right? I mean, now people are if Donald Trump is great for political news, if nothing else, right? Whether you like him or not.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, not to get too political, definitely we know that there's going to be some changes in tax law. We covered that on last week's show. So we hope all of you get a chance to go back and listen to that show in the iTunes or Blog Talk Radio episode list. But today, we've got a great show planned. We're going to get to the topic as soon as possible. We know it's going to go in depth and take some time. So we want to get there quickly. But we're going to be talking about insurance for real estate investors, properties. Matt and I invest in real estate. We've got so many clients around the country that do. We've encouraged it for years. It's a great tax strategy and wealth building strategy. What do you do with insurance? Where do you go for insurance? What type of insurance do you get? We're going to bust it out on this show. It's going to be good.
Yeah, and we got John Slowey, who's going to be our expert, coming on. He's an independent insurance agent that's got a lot of experience. And, you know, we're going to break it down. Like, what do you need to buy? What's nice to have? I mean, this is insurance. This is not healthcare insurance that you have to buy. Remember that? Obamacare. We'll see if that lasts. But, you know, this is – you got to pick and choose, I guess, in the real estate world for your rental properties. So – we're excited for this topic. I'm excited to learn myself because I've always had a few questions that I don't know the answer to. I tell people to ask their insurance agent, and we're going to do that on the show today.
Yeah. Well, if you're a regular listener, you know what's coming next. If not, you're new to our program. We do a tax tip and a legal tip quite quickly here at the beginning of every show. We're trying to make sure we are always throwing out something new that every listener can benefit from. And then we have a question of the week where we challenge your knowledge and have a prize for that. And then we dive into our topic. So first, tax tip.
A tax tip you can actually understand and won't put you to sleep.
A tax tip that could save you thousands.
All right, Matt. Well, I'm going to throw down here on the tax end of things. And I want to talk about gifts. Taking a tax deduction for gifts, huh?
Yeah, tis the season.
It is the season. And I've had a couple calls this week. Mark, what is tax deductible when it comes to gifts? Now, let me give you the line from the IRS, what the specific rule says, and then we can talk about some creativity. The specific rule is, and buckle up, this is going to shock you, gifts are only deductible up to $25 per gift. That is the allowable gift expense for business purposes. It's got to be a business purpose, but you can give someone a gift and you get a deduction of $25. Now, realtors, no self-respecting realtor would even think of giving a gift of $25 or less. They get a slap in the face from their client that they just schmoozed. And so We know it's hard because you're going to give gifts that are more than $25. So here's a couple tips. First, when it comes to your employees and gifts you might be doing around Christmas, if you're going to give cash or gift cards of cash, please know that those need to be included in the W-2 amount of the employee. You can't just give cash and expect to take a tax write-off and then the employee just walks away. You have to include it in their W-2. So be cautious there. But one thing my partners and I did one year is we gave out iPods for Christmas. And these were $200 or $300 a pop. And it's right when they came out. They were kind of a sexy gift. But what we did is, to many of our employees' dismay, we did download on the iPod a bunch of tax training before we gave them the iPod. And so we said, here's your Christmas gift of an iPod. And by the way, there's some tax training downloaded on that iPod for you. So we took it as a training expense rather than a gift expense and did not have to include it in their W-2s. So that was a creative strategy. Keep in mind a couple other fast points is your Christmas parties. If more than 50% of those attending are employees or vendors or customers and not family, it is 100% deductible. It is not limited by the 50% dining rule. So make sure those company parties build morale and relationships with vendors and customers and your employees, and they can be 100% deductible. The last thing I was going to say, and many of you know this, is you can bury a lot of gifts in marketing. Now, you don't want to get too aggressive in this area. I know it's a very gray area. A very challenging IRS agent could have some problems with gifts that you're going to call marketing when they really are truly gifts. But if you can find ways to logo items, create a marketing strategy to go with certain gifts, benefits that people receive, where you're getting your name out there, think about advertising for some of your gifting. But talk to your accountant, make sure you are in a safe harbor on that. So it's a tricky one, Matt. Mm-hmm. It's a hard one.
I love that. I love those ideas. I know employees would hate, you know, they hate when you give them a bunch of cash, you say, oh, by the way, we took out, taxes are going to come out on your next paycheck. So that's going to be smaller than what you're used to. That's like the gift that keeps on giving, unfortunately. So that one is always kind of a bummer, yeah. I know. But the cash is exciting. I love the idea on the iPod with, you know, maybe a Mark Kohler audiobook. Who knows? All right. Well, I got to give a legal tip here. That was an awesome tax tip. Man, I got to get my game up.
A legal tip that you can actually use.
A legal tip where you don't feel like you have to take a shower after.
All right. Now, here's a legal tip, and I'm going to call this the sole prop sweet spot. All right? I'm going to just trademark not to be used without the written consent of Matthew Sorensen, Inc., or any of its affiliates. All right. The sole prop sweet spot. I want to talk about this. I've had some interesting conversations with clients that just have a side business. They're asking, do I do an LLC? Do I do an S-Corp? Should I just be a sole prop? And where am I? Do I fit? Who's in the sole prop sweet spot? And I think there's a lot of people who, for example, I have a friend that's an Uber driver. And he's asking me questions, you know, he's got a W-2 job normally, works for a company, but he makes some money on the side, just driving Uber at nights or on weekends. And he thinks he'll maybe make $750 a month extra from this. You know, Uber has some insurance that you have to buy to make sure you have, and they have their own insurance, and you jump through all those things. So, but it's only $750. Maybe it's going to be $10,000 a year. There's some expenses he gets. You know, he's going to get 1099 on this. Or has been, at least in the past, that Uber's going through lawsuits on all this. But, you know, it's $10,000 or less of income. There's not much liability. There is a lot of insurance through Uber with driving, and he has his own insurance for himself with his car that has liability insurance. Do I need an LLC for that? Do I need an S corporation? Or let's take someone just getting commission income. I don't care what you're in sales, you're a real estate agent, you're network marketing, whatever it is. It's commission income and it's $10,000 or less. There's not a lot of liability in it, and you're $10,000 or less of income. Those are really, I think, the sole prop sweet spot. it's great to have that side business. There's a lot of expenses you can put into that business. You can be paying your kids out of that business. You can be taking home office deductions. You can be buying some, you know, paying your cell phone bill that you use in the business. You could, there's a lot of things that now you're a business owner, you've got a business, you've got some excellent areas for business expenses. But do I need to pull the trigger on an entity? And in those scenarios, keep in mind, there's always two things we're looking at when we're deciding to do an entity. Do you have liability in that business? In which case, we want to have an entity for that, maybe an LLC. Or do you have a lot of income after your expenses? I shouldn't say a lot, but enough income after expenses that you're going to save on taxes. And we're thinking 30, 40,000 of net income at least to come through, because then we like to do an S corporation to save on taxes. So if you don't have a lot of liability in what you're doing, and your income is maybe 10,000 or less, and this is just a great thing you're doing on the side, that's the sole prop sweet spot. Just keep doing the sole prop. If it grows and you end up making more money and that business expands, then maybe you need an S corp, or maybe you're going to have more liability because you're doing more business, and an entity is a great fit. But I love that small business on the side, maybe making 10 grand a year. It's the sole prop sweet spot. Don't stress out about having an entity yet. You can grow into it. That's my legal tip.
Ooh, man, that was a good one. But man, you were playing with fire with that sole prop sweet spot. I felt like, it was kind of a holiday special talking about sweaty balls. I wanted to be really careful about making any connotations or alluding to anything. But I thought you handled it very tastefully, and there was no connotations there whatsoever. I'm sure some of our more...
I had to choose my words carefully. I had to choose my words carefully.
I was very impressed. I know some of our religious fans that love to joke around with this. They're going to say, Matt, that was artful. So good job. But that was a great tip, by the way, too. Now, our question of the week. And everybody knows that this question of the week, we need to get a jingle for this. We will have one soon. We want Matt to come up with a riff on his own electric guitar and record that for us. Former band member, Spilby Dog, Matt Sorensen. But we are going to talk about our question from last week, and then Matt will be posing a new one for this week, where you have the chance to win a copy of one of our books. We had a winner. I'm actually on the road today. Broadcasting live from the Entrepreneur Magazine 360 conference in Long Beach, California. And so I don't have access to my printout. I had our winner printed out and sitting on my desk. So I will make sure that we reach out to that winner and announce their name on the show at another time. I feel bad. They were waiting for that moment of fame, I'm sure. But maybe they just wanted a copy of our book, and that's all. So they'll at least get that. So the question last week was, you went to a small deli for a soup and sandwich, and you went through the line for your soup, and this guy serving was just so rude. He was insulting, and moreover, you sat down to have your soup, and it tasted terrible. It was a waste of your time, and you took it upon yourself to get on social media and just tear this business owner a new one, and you got carried away, and not only did you say his food was terrible and the service was terrible, you called this guy a Nazi, a white supremacist, soup Nazi individual, and you really threw out some hateful words. And that's bad stuff. I mean, it's kind of funny. I used that example from a week ago, and now we've had a lot of really some people that are throwing out hateful words. And that's not a good thing. So no matter what political party you're from, no one ever wants to see that happen. But you got carried away, and you said these sorts of terrible things in your social media post. Are you held liable for that? Will you be maybe subject to a lawsuit for defamation, slander, ooh, heavy words? Well, my friends, the answer is you could have some major legal problems. And we had a listener email me in and say, Mark, you could be subject to a lawsuit and lose. And that's the correct answer. So Matt's covered this before on some articles in the past. I give him credit for that. But it is a scary world out there of what you may post on someone's social media. And if you say some very damaging things that are not true and just to get back at someone, you could be subject to damages in a lawsuit. And it's not pretty. It's hard to put something up and just take it right back down. Be careful what you throw out there. Did your mom ever tell you that? Well, anyway, you folks hopefully got a little legal tip today that you can be legally liable for saying bad things on someone, about someone on social media or on a some sort of bulletin board. Be careful what you post online.
Yeah, and I just, you know, don't send out negativity into the world. You know, that's just my mantra. But I know we do like to – I like giving reviews. And when someone gives poor service, it is helpful for other people to know, hey, this place is terrible. But stick to the facts. Be specific about your situation and don't go overboard. That's where you get into liability. Love the tip. Well, I got the question for this week. And I'm kind of wading into the tax waters here, Mark. So this is a nice question. This is – I want the answer. The answer we're looking for is, what is – the annual income you can make and still have a 0% capital gains tax? You may be surprised to know there is actually a 0% capital gains tax rate. And you have to be in a, you know, lower income. Obviously, high income people aren't going to get this. But you might be surprised on how high that goes for a joint, a married couple. So give me the answer for a married couple. What is the annual income you can have and still have a 0% long-term capital gain tax rate? This means you've owned an asset and sold it in a year. You get to pay zero income tax on it for capital gains taxes. What is the annual income maximum amount you can have and still get a 0% capital gains tax rate? That's question of the week.
And Matt, let me add to this as the resident accountant on the show. This is a trick question. It can be. So let me provide one last piece of clarity for those out there ready to text in your or on your smartphone, email us your answer. And that is, keep in mind that your regular income is combined with the actual income of the sale of the asset. That's the level of income. You may say, well, Mark, I only made X dollars in my job, but I sold this property and made 200 grand. Oh, it's the combination of those two types of income that creates that threshold for capital gains rate of zero. So find that rate, folks. Now, if you have an answer, you just have to email it to the incredible Matt Sorensen, M-A-T, at kkoslawyers.com, or myself, Mark, M-A-R-K, at kkoslawyers.com. You can include a gift certificate or some sort of redemption for a Christmas gift. It is my birthday next week, so feel free to include anything extra you would like with your answer. We will gladly accept it.
Yeah. Those forms of persuasion just never – they always work. They're never getting old. So
yeah.
All right. Well, that's question of the week. Thanks so much for everybody for who does participate. And please send in your answers. We love getting them, and we love reading the winners on the air. And we also love shipping out free books because, you know, 'tis the season right now. It's a time of giving. Well, Mark, we want to get into our topic today and talk about real estate, owning rental properties and property and the insurance, navigating those waters. So let's turn now to our excellent guest we have prepared for today. And I'm going to let you introduce him. And I'll let you introduce this topic too.
Well, it's now time to introduce our special guest. We are so excited, as we've been talking about here for a few minutes, off and on, as we've covered our regular tips. You know, the time has now come to introduce, we're excited. This is a big deal. We've got John Sloway out of Manhattan Beach, California, AMZEC Insurance Services. And the big thing here, folks, the big takeaway and why we asked John to be on the show is not only does he know insurance, and he's given me some good tips lately, he is an independent insurance broker rather than, as John will explain maybe to some of us, what's called a captive, where he's stuck selling a main national product where flexibility can be very challenging. So we're excited to have John here with us. He's got probably 10 different companies or more he can turn to get things done for clients when they're doing projects around the country. And that's from umbrella insurance to real estate to medical or health insurance, life insurance. He knows it all. So John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
All right. Now, John, I presume you have a certain dance you do when you score a touchdown, like a discount double check.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's I've done that. I hopefully Don't do like the Allstate guy does with the bandages and the scars and the scrapes.
Yeah, let's avoid that. Yeah, Mayhem, I believe is his name. All right. Well, thanks so much for being here. Well, I want to just set this out the first time. I mean, Mark kind of described independent broker versus captive. I mean, captive sounds. I mean, God, it sounds like someone's been sentenced to imprisonment or something. You're a captive. It sounds like you've been captured. But give us a quick breakdown when someone's shopping for an insurance agent. You know, a lot of our clients are small business owners, real estate investors, entrepreneurs. They may be looking for personal insurance, business insurance, insurance for their rental real estate properties. What's the difference is they're out there looking for an insurance provider?
Yeah, first off, there's really nothing wrong with either delivery system. The captive agency generally is a person or male or female or a smaller office. They generally know their markets, local markets within several square miles of their agency. A lot of times they're storefront type agencies, and they are
John,
quite
you're
good.
Being nice. I'll interject. You're being nice, but we're talking about the Allstates, the State Farms, the Farmers. That's what people would refer to as a captive, right? I'll say it, and that's okay. But
that's absolutely right. And again, I actually do refer some business to folks like that. Just like you said, sometimes it's a one-man shop, and I can't meet their needs, and so I will refer over to them. And then when they have stuff that's outgrowing their agency, they'll actually send things to me. So it's not an adversarial relationship. It's just a different market. Then the other type of agency is called an independent agent or an independent broker, such as myself. I don't work for an insurance company like the Allstate, the State Farm, and the Farmers guys do. I am an independent, so I work for the client. So the client tells me what they need, and then I go to the various markets that I have, the various insurance companies that I have, and I find the best match, whether it be a price or a service or a type, and I match those up with the client.
This role that you play as an independent agent is really powerful because a lot of our clients have business interests in sometimes multiple states. They have rental properties in multiple states. And being an independent generally, correct me if I'm wrong, you're able to maybe help an entrepreneur in a more broad way and broad fashion.
That's correct. I would be less helpful if he has one rental property. Maybe he owns a house and then he's renting out another house in the same town. I would be less helpful there. That's where your captive agencies probably can fit nicely and have a good price. But when they start to branch out, such as some of your previous guests, and they have 200-unit apartment buildings or maybe six or seven different six-unit buildings or, you know, they do that kind of a thing. That's where it's better, I feel, to have an independent agent working for you because, frankly, the Allstates and the State Farms and the Farmers can't really provide the type of insurance and the various levels of insurance that I can provide. So that's where I start to really get involved. And you also mentioned earlier about the multi-state situation. Again, that's where I can really shine because I can work in virtually every state in the union.
Now, give me an idea in terms of someone with multiple properties, whether they're single family or they're multifamily properties. Are there ways you can get discounts on insurance because you have multiple properties? Is it best to, you know, a lot of our clients I know are just spread out and they may have an agent that's in one area for these couple properties and then they're in another state that they have a different agent for. Is there savings in consolidating to one provider for your insurance for multiple properties? Is that something just in the real estate context worth trying to do?
Yes, it can produce a savings. The law of large numbers will definitely help. If you write a single policy with multiple locations, the fixed costs of putting that policy together are the same whether you do it six times or one time. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, there is some inherent savings in that. And there are also some volume discounts that also might be applicable. Plus, if you are bringing multiple properties, let's face it, that's bigger premiums and absolutely more commissions for the agent. So they're going to be more incentivized to work on a larger account than they are a smaller account.
All right. Now, one of the things that I get a question about all the time, and it's challenging to give a real intelligent answer. And I tell clients that, hey, I'm not an insurance agent, but here's what I understand. So I'm anxious to hear from the horse's mouth here if I'm, you know, steering my clients wrongly, which I'd feel terrible about. But I think but I don't know the details. And here's the question I get all the time. Mark, I'm a brand new business owner. I also have a rental property. What type of insurance do I need? I mean, I know we got the umbrella question. We got health insurance and my own home. I think people can get their head around their own homeowner's insurance. But once they open a business and they have a rental property, can you explain the different types of insurance that they need to consider?
Sure. And there's a really easy way to look at it. And I divide up insurance into basically three simple areas. There's the must-haves, there's the should-haves, and there's the nice-to-haves. And then I guess, go ahead.
Sounds like my hobbies. I like it. Okay.
Yeah. And then I actually, for this type of insurance, for property and for rental insurance, there's also a fourth area that I'll say, and sometimes you're better off not having insurance at all. And we'll get into that a little bit later on. But the must-haves are the ones that you're legally required to have. Now, you're not legally, if you own a piece of property, unless the bank or the loan on the property requires you have insurance, you don't need to have insurance on your property. It's not technically required. There's no government law or anything saying you have to. But if you own that property, it's really a good idea and you have money invested in it and something should happen to it, you'd hate to lose it. So I would consider property and liability insurance a must-have for your properties. And then one other area that if you have property managers that are on site, for example, like a person who's working for you full-time on the site or sites, they need to have workers' compensation insurance. And if they don't have it themselves, guess what? You're responsible for providing them with workers' comp. So that would also be a must-have as you get into the larger areas or have people working for you. Next area, the should-haves. These are areas that you really should have them. And I would say umbrella insurance is probably a good idea there, umbrella liability, especially if your property is especially valuable or if you have a fair amount of wealth on your own and you want to make sure that that wealth is defended in a lawsuit. And then the nice to haves are things like loss of income. By that I mean if something should happen to your property and your renters have to move out for a few days or a few weeks, you'd like to have insurance to cover that rent if they're gone. But that can be expensive and you have to weigh the cost of that insurance versus just basically covering that loss of income on your own for a few months. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And before you go on to the next one real quick, let me just follow up on that. Is as a homeowner, I get homeowner's insurance. As a landlord, what type of insurance do I get? What's the name of it?
Okay. It's basically called property and liability insurance, and it's usually sold as a package. Property and liability. It can be sometimes called, if you're in a business and you want to insure the properties as a business, it can be called a BOP or a business owner's policy. But really it boils down to just a package policy of property and liability.
That's a good MBOP. That was a great song by Hanson, Mark's favorite band. MBOP, 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 MBOP. All right, we can edit that out if it doesn't sound good. All right. Well, maybe you can explain liability insurance. And we're talking about this in the property context. I want to jump to maybe I got a storefront business, but maybe give me some examples of liability insurance, what that's covering. Let's say I've got a tenant in there There's a slip and fall, or for example, or give me some examples of claims you've seen, or the typical liability case that this insurance is protecting you from in the liability situation.
Yeah, it's a great question. Great question. And the liability portion is slip and fall is a perfect example of that, or any kind of, like, to use the, what little lawyer speak I know, any kind of a tort. So if you have a person, maybe you have a stair rail that's not working very well, or for your clients back east, if you haven't cleared the ice off of the sidewalk or your parking lot and they slip and they fall there, they can sue you for their bodily injury or any kind of damage that's done, and not only just for the medical bills, but also for their pain and suffering. And that's where claims can get rather expensive. So that would be a good example of a liability. If they burn themselves on an oven that is in their unit, that would not be an example of a lawsuit. They did that to themselves. But it's something on your property where they do something because of your landlord's negligence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good example.
Now, what I've heard before, and I've kind of been, for good or bad, a promulgator of this concept, is that if I've got a rental property that, let's say, has black mold, and I didn't know about it, and I had a mold problem, and then come to find out the tenant is suffering, their health is suffering, and there's a claim, there's a tort. This is one where I see the interplay between insurance and an LLC, where the insurance policy will probably have some sort of exemption or exclusion for mold. Say, we're not going to cover any mold-related damage. But then the LLC steps to the plate and protects the homeowner, where we see this 1-2 punch where the LLC and the insurance complement each other, because the LLC would protect the homeowner or the landlord or us, the investor, because as long as we were unaware of the mold and we were acting like a responsible property owner and landlord, and as soon as it came to our attention, we solved it, the LLC would protect us. So sometimes the LLC steps in to help us. Sometimes the insurance steps in to help us. Is the mold a good example? Is that typically an exclusion, or how do you see that interplay?
I see mold as an exclusion more often than not. Because the problem with mold is versus insurance, this mold is not something that occurs quickly and over time, like a flood or a windstorm or something like that, or fire. Mold builds up over time, and so insurance companies are extremely reticent to cover mold, and it's frequently excluded in a policy.
And so, okay, very good. And then that's, Matt, where I've always mm-hmm. said, and Matt, probably in your consults, you do the same thing, is that some people, I had a client the other day that said, well, my LLC doesn't protect me. I was at a conference. I go, no. The LLC will protect you when you act like a responsible landlord. If you're a slum landlord and you don't care about mold or meth lab problems or damages and, you know, the railing on the stairs that John was just referencing, if you don't go fix that, then you're going to have a problem with your LLC. And there might even be an insurance problem. I mean, the insurance company, they don't want to cover these slum landlords either that don't fix things.
Yeah, they won't even, sometimes an insurance company won't even cover you. And that's kind of where, if you want, we can get into some of the factors that affect the cost of the insurance. Some of the biggest areas and the way insurance is costed on various properties, obviously square footage, which I would consider the size and the number of units, and then also the income, rent rolls, or just what's your rental income. And the insurance companies will use a combination of those two or one or the other to determine what your cost is. And then you either get a discount or an additional charge because of several different areas. And I'll just go and mention each one slowly if people are taking notes. First of all, your location. If you're in a fire zone, like you're right next to a forest or something like that, or in a flood zone, so location plays part. The age of the building and the condition of the building, and frequently insurance reps will come out, representatives of the insurance company will come out and take pictures or survey the site. So as a matter of fact, another good point here is that it's why it's so important for landowners and landlords to have at least the front of the property look nice, because frequently these folks will do drive-bys. They may not survey the site, but they will actually drive by and take a quick look. And if it looks nice on the outside, then they're not as worried about the inside. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the curb appeal. You got to have good curb appeal.
Right. Now, the next area is making sure that all of your heating and air conditioning, your electrical, your plumbing, and your roof are all up to date. In other words, we will ask, when's the last time that was replaced or redone? Then the next thing is security. And not only security of the building, but if you have a pool, security of the pool. That also will affect your cost. And some insurance companies won't cover buildings that aren't secure. Last one that I'll mention for this list is whether your building is sprinklered or you have alarms, both fire and burglary. Those can also affect your price. And if you have sprinklers and alarms, it affects it very favorably.
Mm. Well, those are some good practical tips to understand how to keep insurance low, I guess, so you know what factors maybe to work on to get premiums down. I want to go back, though. We were talking about LLCs, and you know, a lot of most real estate investors that have multiple properties or single family, or you know, even one or two, or certainly multifamily, they're all owning these typically in LLCs. Now, is the process different when you're going out and getting insurance in the LLC versus you personally? Maybe you just got one rental that you own personally that's not in an LLC. What's the difference in processes you're getting insurance for those properties, if there is any?
No real difference. An LLC, as you and I know very well, is a good way to put a level of protection between yourself and your properties. And so the LLC would simply be the policyholder. So you would need to use the tax ID of the LLC and so forth. And you just handle it just like you would any other business. It doesn't matter to me personally whether they do it as an individual or as an LLC, but I certainly subscribe to your folks' wisdom on using an LLC for multiple properties rather than your own personal ownership.
So the price doesn't change. I've heard that if you, you know, I have client, maybe this is because they're going to captives that don't like LLCs. They generally, they're going after that mom and pop type client. But I've heard that you pay higher premiums if your LLC gets the policy versus you. Have you not seen that?
No, I would never find any way to discriminate against anybody positively or negatively, whether they were a sole proprietor, an LLC, an LLP, a S-Corp, or even a C-Corp. It doesn't matter. It doesn't affect my price at all, and I'd be shocked if it made any kind of a difference.
I think what may happen, Mark, is they may be going to their personal insurance agent who gives them maybe a discount if it's added with their personal policies, maybe, perhaps, I don't know, and then versus getting an LLC. So,
now that's true. I do very little personal insurance, but I do know on my own behalf, is if I have my house and my car and an umbrella policy, I get a deal on all three. But I can tell you right now, if you have a rental property and you try to cover that under your homeowners, there's a good chance it's not going to be covered. So be very, very careful with doing that under a homeowner's policy.
Well, I have a girl named Flo, and she told me if I bundle, I'm going to save. whatever Flo says. But you know what's interesting here? One personal experience that was quite powerful for me is this was years ago, but we had two or three rental properties, and I was working with my dad and my brother, and we had two or three commercial buildings, and they were in three different states, and I had three different insurance agencies and three different premiums and three different headaches, if you will. And I first started to help clients with this business planning, and this was early in my career as a lawyer and accountant as well. And I remember saying, you know what, I've had it. And I called my three different agents, and I think I added one to the mix and said, here's the deal. I want one policy. I want them all covered. I want better insurance, and I would like to save a few bucks if possible. But most importantly, I want some efficiency. Of the four guys, two of them didn't even call me back, didn't even care. And I think they probably couldn't do it. And then I got quotes from the other two, reluctantly, from one of them. And one guy was like, Mark, I'd love to bundle these all together. Multiple states, not a problem. I ended up getting better coverage. And overall, I save premiums of almost $6,000 a year. And I was like, oh, my gosh.
I believe it. I believe it. Now, commercial properties are a little different in that they can be more easily bundled because they're more they're more similar to each other. And I was going to touch base on that a little bit. I used an example when I was doing a little research in preparation for this call, and I pretended like I was a person who owned six properties, three, you know, in California, a townhouse, a fourplex, a prefab, one property of six units in Arizona, one in a condo in Park City, Utah, and a fourplex in Las Vegas. And I just pretended, first I went online, you know, and a lot of people might want to do that. Hey, you know, I don't need to use anybody. I'll just go online and do it myself. Well, be very careful with that because you get referred into some really weird places. I mean, different companies and different brokers, and sometimes you get referred directly into like a Travelers or a Hartford. Nothing wrong with that, but you end up in really strange places that, and you don't have control of what's going on. Another big problem with the internet and that I have as a broker is all these different insurance companies all have different rules about the kinds of properties that they're willing to cover. For example, Travelers. You can go direct to Travelers, but if you have more than three units, you can't. They will say, sorry, after all that application that you went through, spending a half hour on the internet, they say, oh, you have more than three properties? You have to go to an independent agent like me. So a lot of times, you got to be really careful. Farmers, another good example. They won't do anything over five units, which is another rule I didn't even know about until I called them. So that's why I definitely feel the independent broker is useful. Now, that said, there are drawbacks. In my example of the property as a makeshift property owner, they could do the they couldn't do the prefab in Murrieta, and they couldn't do the condo in Park City. So I would have to farm those out to somebody else to help on those. Why? I don't know. But I just couldn't get coverage for them. So I had to. I would have to contact another agent or broker to help out on that one. One other thing that you said that's really, really cool about, though, trying to get as many of these under a common policy as possible, and that's different policies all have different effective dates, and it's a nightmare trying to keep track of all the different effective dates and, you know, all the things you have to do for each property. It can get very, very confusing. So I agree with you. Try to get as many of you men as you can under a common effective date. Besides saving money, it's a lot easier on your brain.
All right. Well, let me ask about making claims and the actual process of claims. What should people know about ahead of time before they're making claims? What is just some good advice about claims? I got to make a claim, you know, or I'm going to own multiple properties. I know a claim is going to come down eventually. What's some good advice that people could heed now before they need to make a claim?
Loss prevention. Sometimes landlords are unwilling to make suggested fixes. I, as an agent or a broker, will go out to the property and take a look at it even before the carrier does. And I'll take some pictures. And if I see anything that doesn't look right, like that broken stair rail, I'll say, hey, you got to get that fixed because that is a claim waiting to happen. Mm-hmm. So loss prevention is the key. Then the next thing to do is what I say is loss control. In other words, if you see something that happens after the fact, get it fixed as quickly as possible to avert a claim. Now, on the actual claim submission process, sometimes you're better served not to submit the claim, but to fix it yourself. And that was one of those areas that I was going to talk about where you don't have any insurance at all. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're better off self-insuring. Example, if the cost of repairing the small fire you might have had in a unit or something like that is going to cost you $3,000, but submitting the claim is going to cost you $10,000. That's obviously a no-brainer. But also, you don't want to have any claims on your record if you can avoid it. Insurance companies don't like claims, obviously. Mm-hmm. They will pay them. But if you ticky-tack them and you keep hitting them up for little claims here and there, eventually you might very well find yourself getting canceled. So here's what I do. If I have a claim, or I know I have a claim and I'm trying to decide whether to fill it or not, what you do is you call your insurance company. You say, look, I don't have a claim right now. This is purely theoretical. And you just tell them that because they're recording you. If I had a claim and if I had this much damage and if I submitted it to you, what do you think would be the process? And they will give you the theoretical answer. And that way it doesn't go on your record. Because even if you, this is important, because even if you don't say theoretically, if you say I have a fire and I'm trying to decide whether to fix it or not, they can count that against you just like a real claim. Mm-hmm. Wow. They really can.
That's interesting. What do you think about when it comes to loss prevention? Matt and I were talking about this before the show. Should we be telling all of our clients and ourselves, Matt and I have rentals, should we once a year take a video camera around and video our property inside and out and just save it on a flash drive or put it on in a folder somewhere? Is that?
That is a cool idea. And I don't know many landlords who do that, but I think it's a wonderful idea. Even pictures are even good. And that's what I do. I will go out to a property and I'll take pictures right off the bat. Been doing this long enough now to recognize, you know, problems when I see it. But again, the insurance company will probably do the same thing if there's enough, you know, money involved. So, but that's a great idea. And that obviously also protects you from from any claims that your renter might make against you as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, I got a question about additional insureds. A lot of times we'll see that, you know, maybe I've got, again, let's go to the LLC that I have that owns some rental property. I need to add maybe myself as an additional insured. So maybe my property manager says, hey, you need to add us as an additional insured. Tell me about that and how does that work? What the heck does that mean? Does it cost me more? What's that process?
The cost is minimal, generally. Generally, you'll see banks any kind of additional property interest. Maybe you have other private lenders that they want to be named as additional insureds. That covers them from any potential claim against them. Because as you folks know, if there is a claim, the claimant is going to, or the claimant's attorney is going to name any person or place or thing that they can think of. And they may even leave a few blank areas to name people later on. So banks definitely want to be additional insureds. You might find contractors want to be listed as additional insureds.
Property managers.
Property managers can be as well. So it doesn't – the cost – there might be a minor cost to do it, but it's not ridiculous, and it's certainly worth its weight in gold.
Well, I could keep talking about insurance all afternoon. I know it sounds crazy that I even said that. Something's wrong with me.
Crazy.
I'm getting crazy my old age here. But one more question. I know Matt and I wanted to cover this, and we've written some articles about it, and it's good, again, to hear it from the horse's mouth, and that's umbrella insurance. Maybe we could finish on that topic for a moment. Mm-hmm. The way I've described it is many people think it's a filler that, oh, if my normal insurance doesn't cover me, my umbrella will. When really umbrella is there to step in when you hit policy limits of something already covered. But if your insurance doesn't cover it, doesn't mean your umbrella is coming to your rescue. I don't know. There's so much misinformation out there, I think. Tell us, am I right? And what do you think people should know about umbrella?
Yeah, that's accurate. Umbrella liability insurance, and sometimes it's called blanket liability insurance, will not step in until the other underlying policies are exhausted. So For example, if you have a property and liability insurance policy and its maximum is $1 million, well, guess what the deductible is on the umbrella policy? It's $1 million. So it doesn't even start to involve itself until after the base is exhausted. Now, one good thing about an umbrella liability policy is it can be written over the top of multiple policies. So in a situation like I was just mentioning where I couldn't get coverage for a condo in Utah, but I could get coverage, and I couldn't get coverage for my prefab in Murrieta, but I have coverage under my broker for all the other ones, but I have to use a different broker and a different insurance company for those two. Well, guess what? My umbrella liability policy will cover those two outliers. So as long as they're listed and named, that's kind of a cool thing about the umbrella policy. So a good way to judge an umbrella policy is if you have a fair amount of property, and I would say if you have more than two properties, I would highly recommend umbrella coverage, because the peace of mind for having, for example, an additional $3-5 million of coverage is well worth the price. And one other good point about that is when you have that kind of coverage in play, it's not that the person who's suing you is going to go after that full amount, but the attorneys for the various insurance companies have a duty to defend. In other words, they're going to defend a policy for $5 million much more diligently and much more aggressively than they're going to defend a policy for $250,000. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Now, let me make sure I understood your example right. Those properties you had, let's say the Park City condo and the Murrieta rental, that were not covered when you went out to go get your initial insurance. You said the umbrella would cover them, but I presume you went and got some other insurance agent involved to get your primary insurance on those properties, right? You're saying
correct.
The umbrella would come on top of those.
Correct. It doesn't matter that they're not all covered under the same policy or the same broker. As long as you have base coverage, it will step in on any of those, which is kind of cool about umbrella insurance. Oh, let me finish on at least on one area that I mentioned. Remember the must-have, the should-have, and the nice-to-have?
One of the
areas that's very, very important for folks to understand is sometimes you're better off not having any coverage at all. And I think I use the example of what they call loss of income insurance. Sometimes you're better off self-insuring that if you can manage, not having that rental income come in for a few months. And another area would be things like acts of nature, like in Florida. The hurricane insurance in Florida, as you might guess, is extremely, extremely expensive, and sometimes it's just plain old not worth it. So, and that's where I would help. I help people understand, hey, you know, this isn't something that you really need. I think I would just pass on this.
Fantastic info. I love this conversation. I, again, geeking out on it. I just know that, and I wanted to summarize with this, is that people really don't understand the interplay between LLCs and good legal planning and good insurance planning. They really go hand in hand. And some people put all their eggs in their insurance basket and think, oh, I'll just throw legal protection to the side. And then vice versa, people just say, oh, well, I've got my entity, so I don't need to worry about insurance. When they really do complement each other, they cover for each other, they work together, and it can be affordable. You can be very strategic about this. And John, I want to say thanks for coming, and any final words maybe on that point or any others, and how people can get a hold of you to get some advice on their rentals and investments.
Sure. One of the areas that I would close with was, you don't mind me mentioning, I found Jay Massey's presentation extremely valuable for people who are interested in getting into rentals. And one of the areas that he mentioned was point number four, and that was his team, assembling a team. An insurance broker or even an insurance agent, whether it be captive or independent, should be part of your team. Because we're there with you all the time, and we will help you if you're buying, if you're selling. So I consider myself a team member for folks like that. So that's a good point, and that's where I like to be, as a team member. get a hold of me via my website, www.amzec, that's A-M as in Mary, Z as in zebra, E-C, insurance.com. That's the best way to get a hold of me.
All right, John. Well, thanks so much for being on. We appreciate your expertise. And, of course, we're going to be back next week with another amazing show on topic. But I want to also give you guys a reminder to give us a 5-star review if you like the show on iTunes. We know many of you find the show on the podcast app on iTunes. And if you like the show, tell us you love the show. Give us a 5-star review. We did have some new ones come in we haven't mentioned yet. So I just want to give a shout out here. I know this is back in the day, you know, when I listened to FM radio as a teenager, you'd give your shout outs. So I'm going to give a shout out here. L4700, this is your screen name, gave a 5-star review, said, excellent program regarding business practices. If you're interested in acquiring information regarding setting up a business entity, accounting, or legal strategies, this is the show to listen. Mark and Matt are so generous with providing information, either from themselves or experts in their field. Listen wisely, you'll be glad you did. Now, if anybody leaves a 5-star review, this includes L4700, send us an email, let us know you gave us a 5-star review, and Mark and I will say thanks by sending you a free copy of either one of our books. You get to pick which one.
Yeah, and finally, this is important. We got to say this. Next week is the Open Forum show, and it's Thanksgiving week next week. And if any of you have a question and you're like, man, you've been busy, you haven't had the time to schedule a consult with one of our attorneys or accountants, and it's just a quick 5-minute type question, you've been dying to ask it, maybe something simple or easy, maybe a follow-up question to one of these insurance issues, please send us an email. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, at kkoslawyers.com, or Matt, M-A-T, at kkos, as in SorensenLawyers.com. Send a quick email, and we'll cover your questions on the radio show. Last time, we couldn't get to all of them, so we sometimes start out with the questions from last. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and we're excited to be a part of your lives. Happy holidays. We're right around the cusp of that, and so thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next week on the Open Forum Show.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.